XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two, at the races on this Thursday. And this week, earlier in the week, we were, you know, looking to get a little Will Rogers perspective. And the guy that I know in Tulsa, it's been a number of years. When I lived in Kansas City, I used to make sales calls in Tulsa and would come down and stay at the Camelot Inn. And I can't remember if that was Scott Young joins us. I can't remember, Scott, if that's on Yale or Harvard, one or the other. I'm trying to think. That's all I remember. I'd come into Tulsa. Tulsa was so much fun. And I was a young salesman, so getting down to Tulsa. But the guy that I, you know, my go-to guy for Oklahoma is Clark Brewster. And Clark said, you know what, have Scott Young. And so it's a real pleasure to have Scott join us. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. And happy to get you on. I was going to have you yesterday, and we were going to talk about, you know, the runners. And I apologize to the listeners a little bit because we could have given them a couple of winners. But, Clark said, have Scott on. He can tell you everything you need to know about Will Rogers. And, you know, you guys as horsemen during this meet, I mean, it's got to be pretty interesting for you to have all this attention.
Well, it's definitely been fun, and we've gotten a lot of attention across the world, essentially, with this being the only game in town on Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, and our handle because of that has just been through the roof. I mean, we did 5 million Monday, close to 5 million Tuesday, and I think we handled like 4.5 million yesterday on Will Rogers Down.
It's unbelievable. How long have you been – training, under your name and having hanging a shingle 7, 8, 9 years. When did you first start coming to Will Rogers?
Well, Will Rogers was actually the first start I made as a trainer.
I love
after
it.
After I quit riding, and this is home. Will Rogers is home for me. My home's 15 minutes from the racetrack, and I was born and raised in Northeast Oklahoma, so I've been at Will Rogers all my life.
Unbelievable. And you know, for those, I mean, for me, it's a fairly new, you know, I mean, I've seen the races, and sometimes when you're, you know, looking at Remington stuff and you look at some replays, so I had seen things and you know, watched a race or two from there. But I mean, how old of a facility is it, and give us a little bit of perspective.
You know, it's an older — I'm not actually sure how old the facility is. It's been around for quite a while. I mean, I remember going in the late 80s, early 90s, and it had been here a while then, when I was just a young guy.
Well, it certainly has got people's attention. And you also, you know, since you mentioned your riding side of your career, talk about, you know, your origins. I mean, what got you on the racetrack, and you know, what got you on horses?
Well, from the time I was a little kid, all I wanted to do was be a jockey. Now, I will say I wasn't that good at it, but that was essentially the best job I've ever had in my life, and I got to do that for 8 years. My grandparents were I call like weekend warriors, had a few cheap claiming horses that we ran at Blue Ribbon Downs in Salisaw every weekend, and since the time I could walk, I've been at a racetrack and been on the back of a horse, and I believe I galloped my first racehorse when I was 9 years old, and I've been on the back of a racehorse almost every day since then.
Unbelievable. And you know, when you look at you mentioned Blue Ribbon, and you know, you were riding at places like Blue Ribbon and Manor and Fair Meadows, and you know, some of what if it was in Louisiana, we would call them bush tracks.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what they was. But I mean, the time of my life. I mean, I loved every minute of being a jockey.
and I'm trying to think. Who would you say is your was your biggest horse as a rider?
As a rider, was a probably a horse named Special Fight. My it was a long story. The horse was given to my now wife, and we kind of played with this horse a long time, and he ended up winning. He ended up winning a stakes race in every track here in Oklahoma, winning their last thoroughbred race they had at Blue Ribbon Downs, and we set a track record, and I was riding him. The very last race they ever ran, thoroughbred race they ran at Blue Ribbon Downs, he won.
That's great. That is great. Special Fight, F-I-T-E. I see him
correct.
Now. Special Fight, an Oklahoma bred,
correct.
Appropriately. Oh, well, yeah. I got to tell you, I'm just pulling up his record, and he won 19 times in 47 starts. This is the craziest thing, Scott. It's so typical of racing. On Tuesday with Andy Serling, Academy Award came up, a fairly obscure, you know, stake horse. Academy Award was the broodmare sire of Special Fight.
Yep, that is correct.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Pretty funny. The opportunity to start training. Talk about the transition from riding and becoming a trainer.
You know, the transition that I made, I had to step back and I had a couple opportunities present themselves to me to start training, and I was still keeping the bills paid, riding and things like that. But I just had the opportunity to train for the right people. And I said, I eventually knew I was going to train, and the right opportunity became available. And I said, well, if we're ever going to do it, we better do it now. And we got lucky and got off to a pretty good start because we was able to train some very usable horses once we got started.
Well, and there's a couple that that people, you know, any number of names people are going to recognize, and certainly Talkin' Taylor has got to be one of them.
Oh, she was one of the first ones I had. We lost her once in the claim box, claimed her back. She made over $200,000 and never ran in the stakes race. She was just what you call an iron horse. And I mean, she was just the sound the day she walked in my barn and the day she walked out, and has now become a broodmare, and we hope to see good things from her offspring.
Nice. When it comes to making the transition, you know, the big key obviously is attracting some owners, and as well as, you know, whatever you're going to do on your own. Talk about that side. Certainly to have a guy like Clark Brewster on your roster, that helps.
He was one of the first guys that gave me an opportunity and didn't really know me from anybody. A good friend of mine, Roger Engel, had suggested that Clark give me a shot with a couple of horses, and he did. We did okay with them. And then just every year since then, Clark has just kept me, you know, with four or five horses and a lot of his Oklahoma breds. When they come back here to Will Rogers, the homebreds, we get an opportunity to run. And Clark has did nothing but good things for me by giving me that opportunity, and it's allowed me to essentially track other owners just because they see a guy like Clark take a shot with a guy that was at the time virtually unknown, is just, you know, a washed up jockey that's now started training, and Clark gave me an opportunity, and that we ran with it, and it's just been a good deal for me.
Oh, no doubt. And Clark loves every aspect of the game. He's as excited for a nickel claimer or you know, picking one out for 10 or 25 as he is for a stake horse.
He is. I mean, he's just a fantastic guy. I can't say, I've told him this before, but I just can't tell him thank you enough for giving me that first opportunity to train a few of his horses.
Give everybody a bit of a feel for what they need to know about playing Will Rogers, Scott. I mean, what kind of horses and you know, stylistically, because from what we're seeing, at least initially, and Marcus Hirsch talked it over with me on Tuesday, it does feel like, you know, if you're good enough at any style from any point on that track, you got a chance to make a run.
We Will Rogers was once labeled as a speed-favoring racetrack, and it most definitely was. Last year, we lost the last few days of our meet due to some serious flooding issues, and it washed out our track. And the Will Rogers came in last year after that and completely resurfaced the track, whole new base, new material, and it's been a great track, and it has allowed horses from every style, if good enough, a great opportunity to win.
Interesting. You know, for your purposes and you know, for people that are betting, what you know, any suggestions on you know, aside from you, who, you know, is sitting second in the trainer standings, but you know, what kind of angles, the jockey colony, anything that stands out for players?
I tend to think horses towards, they don't have to be on the lead, but I think it's I'm not calling it speed favoring, but horses that are close, that are going to be within five of the lead, usually I think have the best opportunity to win. A lot of Oaklawn shippers obviously come over and do well. I've noticed the last couple of weeks a lot of horses coming off the synthetic tracks at other places have done very well here at Will Rogers over this track.
That and you know, that's an element that, you know, seems to translate. It seems like a fitness thing. They just, you know, they come off the, if you're coming off the poly, and there are some, I have seen some horses that made their way down from Turfway, for instance,
sure.
that are showing up.
I led a horse over the other day that ran second to a 3-year-old coming from Turfway that I expect that horse to go on to do some things, maybe, because he was pretty impressive in that win when I think it was Segui won the other day. And I'm not taking anything away from my horse, but I definitely thought I had the horse to win that race, and I got beat. Flat got beat.
Well, and that was the horse, that was the Bill Morey horse. And in fact, Marcus, that horse was 8-1 on the morning line and got bet down to favoritism. There was a scratch in that race. I think there was a 4-1 that got scratched, which, correct, you know, contributed. But still, Marcus kind of identified him on, I guess that was Tuesday, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, the last few days, you seem to be sending out, you know, at least a winner a day. And then yesterday, you had the pair of winners.
I did. I had the real fast filly for Danny Caldwell that we'd gotten her stakes placed the week before. And she kind of come out of the race bouncing. And this 5/8 furlongs, I mean, the 5-furlong race was perfect for this handicap. And she came back yesterday and ran very, very well for us.
You mentioned Danny Caldwell, and we've had Danny on the show, most notably, you know, after he was wrapping up another Oaklawn owner's title. I mean, there's another guy that you got him on the roster. You know, you're going to have action.
Danny's a great guy to train for. Very realistic when spotting his horses, and you know, we've made quite a few winner circle appearances with Danny's horses over the last 3 or 4 years. He keeps me at Will Rogers usually within 3 to 5 horses. I mean, and a lot of times they get claimed, and he just says, well, when that one gets claimed, I've got 2 more to put there. So he just keeps sending me bullets.
He would much rather, he's got a very practical approach, which is, and so does Clark, actually, when you think about it, you know, put horses where they can win. And if somebody wants to claim them, they claim them. And it doesn't seem like Caldwell or Clark, you know, are married to their horses, and, you know, running them, you know, a couple of ticks above their head so that they don't get claimed, and, you know, maybe they cash checks, but they'd rather win. And if the horse goes on down the road, so be it.
Correct. You know, they're just like, they're like a lot of us. I mean, we just want to win races. I mean, that essentially winning races is what pays the bills. Seconds and thirds help, but you got to win to pay the bills.
No doubt. Scott, are you still getting on horses in the morning?
Every day. I get on horses. And every now and then I still breeze a few horses, but I might be just a little heavy now for that.
I did see a piece. Remington did a little thing last year or the year before, and they had said, you know, you're going for, you know, for queso dip and for pizza. So you're not on your restricted diet anymore.
Not anymore. I did that for 8 years, and I haven't dieted since the last day I rode a racehorse.
I love it. With the circuit that you're on, which essentially is, you know, you're going Sam Houston and Will Rogers and Remington, you know, and obviously being in that region, you know, Lone Star, and you could go to Louisiana if, you know, if there's certain spots or New Mexico. I mean, talk about, you know, staying at a certain, you know, in a certain spot, or are you, you know, are you trying to, you know, steadily upgrade and you know, move toward, you know, getting some horses at Oaklawn, or are you very satisfied with the business that you've got?
I'm very satisfied with what I've gotten. This is actually the first year I did not go to Oaklawn. I mean, I'm a very realistic guy and call a spade a spade. I was at Oaklawn last year and took an absolute beating and just figured I didn't need to do that again. And with Sam Houston increasing the purses, we went to Sam Houston this winter and did very well our first meet at Sam Houston. And I plan on going back. And, I mean, eventually I want to get back to Oaklawn and run races there because, I mean, that's the greatest spot in the world to race is Oaklawn. I mean, I love the place. I love the racing. But as a business perspective, I figured Sam Houston is where I belong this winter instead of Oaklawn. And I plan on going to Prairie Meadows, you know, this summer if things open up. But that's the question nobody can answer for us right now is when is everything going to open up, or are we going to be racing at Will Rogers asking for more days for the until Remington?
Well, has that been? Have you heard how much that's been discussed about extending the meet?
I don't think it's been discussed yet, because obviously, I think other people think the other tracks around are going to start opening up soon. Is what we're hearing. You know, I know Lone Star is wanting to try to get their racing going. I've been in contact with Prairie Meadows. They're wanting to get their race meet started as soon as possible, but with the COVID-19 and everything going on, nobody can provide solid answers of when that will happen and when things will open back up.
Well, and in fact, we reached out to some of the Prairie Meadows associated parties, and they're telling everybody that you know, ideally, early May is their hope that they can get going.
Right.
Well, and that'll have to, you know, for now, that'll have to suffice. Well, Scott Young is joining us from Will Rogers Downs, that has become the focus for plenty of players. And Scott, what's coming up? Nothing in the entries right now, but what do you, you know, what should people be aware of in the barn? I know you got some maidens that have, you know, been knocking on the door, like She's a Rock Star. You got a couple that feel like they're close to a breakthrough.
I've got some that are close. Hopefully next out should perform well. I've got a few first timers coming up in the next week or two that you haven't seen run yet that we expect to run pretty big races off the shelf at a first asking. There's a 3-year-old Oklahoma bred stake race going a mile next week, the Will Rogers Stakes, and I've got a horse named Southgate that I'm putting there that we've got high hopes for. We've kind of ran him in every, since he broke his maiden, we've ran him kind of in every stake there is to run in since then, and this is being back with the Oklahoma Breds, and we expect him to do a pretty big performance next week.
Very nice. And Southgate was in that, I saw where you had Southgate ran a stake, right? Ran in the stake at Sam Houston.
He did. He ran in the Conley, the 3-year-old grass stake. Yeah, he ran in that. And yeah, he didn't get embarrassed. We didn't have the outcome we wanted, but it took a lot out of him, and we gave him just a little bit of time after that race, and he couldn't be training any better right now. He's doing very well right now.
You got an older horse too that who's now six, actually, or she's the mare, not a horse, that North Carolina bred of Danny Caldwell's Drip Brew.
She is just a hard-knocking, just you lead her over there, and she wants to run every day. I mean, she's just as she's a dream to be around, a dream to train, and just loves her job. And just fantastic mare to train. And I think she's still, we're looking for every five and a half furlong race there is for her because she's exceptionally fast.
You tried her. She just ran a nice race, 2 weeks ago? It's 10 days ago in the Mankiller.
10 days ago in the Mankiller. Correct. And then she came back yesterday in the five furlong handicap that they had and went again. And to be honest with you, when we checked her this morning, she acted like she could run tomorrow.
we've got a 6-year-old like that too. We've got Carlisle Bell. I mean, she every single day she goes out to train, you know, she thinks she's in a race. I mean, she just loves being a racehorse. It just throws herself into everything. It's and then as sweet as can be in the barn, in the stall. It's amazing. If they don't get that urge to, you know, to be moms, they would much rather be at the racetrack.
I told somebody yesterday on Drip Brew, I said, I expected that race to go in 58, maybe 58 flat, or, you know, and obviously it ended up going 57 and one, I believe it was. And I said, I feel like Drip Brew could go 58 and change 7 days a week if you wanted her to.
Now, Floyd Wethy was aboard and 6-5 and beat the even money favorite. Just would not let David Cabrera and I'm a Discreet Lady by.
She wouldn't. It was just all heart. She's as game as they come. Even in the Wilma Mankiller, I mean, she cut out all the fractions and put away a couple horses and just got gunned down late. It was heartbreaking, but you couldn't fault her effort. She just tried and give us every ounce of what she had that day in the Wilma Mankiller. We just got gunned down late.
And speaking of Wethy, I give everybody a quick primer, Scott, on the jocks and there's a few guys that we've talked to in here and including Lane Luzzi, of course, Mike's son. Give us a feel. I mean, who's an up and coming rider? Who's your go to guy? Who's a good finisher? Who's the best gate rider in that colony?
You know, Floyd has rode for me the last 2 or 3 years. I've known him since we've known each other since we were little kids. He's an all around just great rider. Very, very strong rider. Good at getting him out of the gates, and just when coming the last 70 yards, he's just a very, probably, I feel like, one of the strongest riders here when needed. Luzzi is an up and coming. He has done great things this year, riding races and things. He's won some races for me this year, and I play golf with them two guys a lot. Them are two of the young guys coming up, and I quit playing with them that much because they both got better than me, and I don't like losing.
I love it. We talked. I remember. I think we talked to Ty Kennedy early on, and he's leading the jockey standings. Actually, he's tied right now with Floyd Wethy, and you're going to go till May 23rd. You got some familiar veteran names, Rye Eichelberry and Ken Tohill over there as well. David Cabrera, is a very solid rider. It's a good colony.
You know, that's a lot more jocks than there has been in the past. I mean, like, we didn't expect to see some of these guys show up, and it's. I mean, you don't have to struggle to find a jock if you don't have if one guy spins you. I mean, there's 20 other great riders here this year to pick them up. I mean, it's not a problem finding a great rider here this year.
Well, and then of course, when it comes to the trainer side, Broberg made some move yesterday. What, he had four wins yesterday, right?
Almost five, but I held him off.
I know you've got a Twitter account, and we'll send it out for everybody. But do you follow Broberg? He's quite the cut up on Twitter.
I do. Carl and I actually are pretty good friends, and speak with him via text a lot throughout the week. He actually told me in the drip brew race yesterday he was going to beat me, and I responded with highly doubt it, but and he almost did, but we kept him held off.
Well, the two wins yesterday put you in a tie with Diodoro, who's a, you know, everybody's got to deal with him all over the country, really. And we certainly going to root for you now and going forward. Scott Young, I really appreciate this. I wanted to get, you know, somebody on from the Will Rogers circuit and give everybody a taste, on a nationwide basis. Obviously, people are getting to know Will Rogers, and it helps, I think, if they, if they can put a voice and put a personality with some of the names.
Well, I sure appreciate you having me on this morning, Steve.
Not at all. And continued success. And for those of you that want to follow Scott, it's S Young 85, S Young 85, and you'll see it today on the listings. Scott Young, stay safe. I can see all the outriders and everybody around the scales. They're all, they're all wearing masks and everybody in gloves, and everybody doing everything they can to keep everybody healthy. Scott Young, folks, there you go. Let's take a break. Bottom of the hour, exactly. 90 minutes in, 90 to come. And Tony Black, we'll see how Tony's week was. And see if he's keeping the kids busy. And and all that, right? Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Developed by Horsemen, Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, environment-friendly, paperless revolution of how equine industries bill and receive payments. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for each horse, whose owners can pay through the same website with just one click. Say goodbye to stacks of invoices, handwritten checks, and postage costs. Easy accounting for all parties with the highest online security measures. Get started free at Horsebills.com. Simply register with your name and email address. Free to sign up. No subscription fees to vendors until the first invoice is sent. For owners, you get a free account, comprehensive dashboard with information on all horses owned and billing records, ACH and credit card payment options. For vendors, generate invoices efficiently and receive payments quickly from both owners and other vendors. Syndicate and partnership managers get flexible billing and payment options to both vendors and syndicate members. For more info, call 888-938-4643, 888-938-4643, or log on to horsebills.com. That's horsebills.com.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
DRF Sports Form Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Form delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
You say you stand by your man. Tell me something I don't understand. You said you love me, and that's a fact. And then you left me, said you felt trapped. Well, some things you can't explain away. But the heartaches in me feel this day. And stand by me.
We're back at the races, 25 minutes to the top of the hour, and Tony Black standing by. We talked to Steve Askin yesterday. Tony, good morning. Everybody all right?
Good morning, Steve. Everybody's all right, even though New Jersey has a high count in coronavirus count. But it's mainly north of us, and the area I'm in, it's been quiet, and everybody's healthy, and my 95-year-old mother is doing real well. And stop complaining about how I have her locked up in the house. But she stopped complaining. But you know what? Your show this morning started out, and you know, I relate to so many things that are said or on your show because we have such a good show. But when you were talking about Milt Wolfson, I didn't have any contact with Milt. But the one thing that you said, and it stood out with the old school horseman, you know, leg man. He was a great leg man. And, you know, the old school horseman, that's what they prided themselves in. I came around with that group or that era of horsemen, and they were the horsemen that spotted the problems when they were in the early stages of developing into a big problem. And I'll never forget my old boss, Charlie Coco. I used to go in the tack room, and he looked like he was a chemist. He'd be mixing up leg paints and different paints, and the base of it would be iodized solution, and everything else he put in them, I don't know what went into them. It was, different things he'd put into them, and he would show me how we want the horse painted, how he wanted painted. And one of the big things that came on the scene at that time in the 60s and 70s when I was rubbing horses was DMSO, and he loved it. You know, you put this on the leg and then paint it in with the DMSO. But they prided themselves in being expert leg men. And I guess Milt was just another example of that era. But never had any contact with him and knew the name, and sad to see the old guys gone and that era of horsemen gone. But it was a great era, and it was wonderful to be around and being taught by people like that.
Part of what is really fascinating, and granted, Milt Wolfson had other income. He had, you know, he had the Neshaminy turf supply, both in the Mid-Atlantic region and in Florida. But still, he was a guy that only typically had 9, 10, 12 horses. And that was it. He wasn't interested in having 30 or 60. He just wanted enough, you know, to have that he could put his hands on and, you know, could manage. And it's you want to talk old school. I mean, and granted, there's a lot of people out there that I don't want to say they're doing it as a hobby, because that's not that's somewhat insulting. They're, you know, they don't have to. The financials aren't creating pressures as they are for many. And so, you know, if they've got 10 horses this week and 8 next week, it's fine. That part of it is really, you know, I don't know how many of that type of gentleman trainer is still out there.
Right, and those are the type of trainers I came around with. I can remember, you know, Charlie, if he ever had a big barn, it would be between 15 and 20, and didn't, you know, it was out of his hands and really didn't look to have more than 15 or 20, and many a time only had 8, 9, 10, 12 horses. Guys like Gene Navarro. Gene Navarro was a quality horseman, you know. They were old school and never had more than horses than what he could keep an eye on every day. And you know what? they taught a lot of people to be trainers, but they didn't have assistant trainers under their barn, you know, aiding them. They did everything that had to be done with that horse and instructed any of the grooms to do whatever they needed to have done with that horse. And they maybe picked out a groom that was an expert, experienced groom, and unofficially made him one of their aides or assistants. But there was never big outfits. A big outfit, oh, I can remember working like walking hot for Buddy Lettman, and he was one of those trainers. He actually had a whole barn, you know, 34 horses in Garden State. But they were few and far between, you know, the guys like Lettman and Sanborn and Kroll and guys like that. They didn't have gigantic stables. Now they talk 50 horses, 100 horses. Oh, he's got three strings, 150 horses. I can even remember working for Jack Vanberg, and he had a lot of horses, but he had a lot of horses in different states. At one point, I can remember when he was training for Shinrun Farm, who was second lead owner of the country that year, and Jack maybe had five or six strings. He didn't have five or six strings and keep it and was the guy who trained five or six strings. He trained his strings and he had horsemen at other racetracks, trainers, training the other strings. And he depended on them and, you know, and he made sure that he had capable people training those strings. And maybe would come in and Jack Vanberg would come in like when Ed Payne was training for him at Shinrun Farm at Delaware Park. And he'd come in and look at one and say, ah, we're going to shoe this horse different. And I'd watch him shoe horses, Jack Vanberg shoeing horses. You know, I saw him do certain things, even tap horses, you know, and he would say, this is how you do the knee. You don't do it the traditional way the vets do it. This is the way you do it. You know, and guys like that, they prided themselves in being expert, old school horsemen, but they didn't pride themselves in having 150 horses under their care. You know what I mean, Steve? It was smaller stables. And that's the way it was. You know, it was a different game at that particular time. And I guess my age is starting to show because I was on the racetrack since I was born on a boarding and training center in Marlton, New Jersey. I got a picture of me with my mother holding a Shetland long-haired Shetland pony and my brother standing next to my mother and me on the Shetland pony, and I say, this is my real first win picture from the farm in Marlton, New Jersey, in 1956 or whatever it was, 57. I was 4 or 5 years old. But it was different in that particular time. You know, the one thing I want to touch on, not before I get off the subject and go on, because of this coronavirus and everything, there was a CARES Act passed. That's the Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security Act. Yep. And it made jockeys eligible for unemployment. You know, and many of my brothers and sisters, jockeys, jockettes. I never believed in that jockette stuff. They're all jockeys, whether girls or boys. You're a jockey. But I've been calling them because I didn't know how many of them were aware of this CARES Act. And told them you can file for unemployment. You know, you're an independent contractor, but this covers you now. You can file. And if you get on, get on the phone and do it and go look up this CARES Act, you'll see jockeys are eligible for unemployment compensation, which is a help. I mean, a lot of these kids, you know, they don't get paid for Galvin horses. There's no racing in their area. And, you know, it comes on hard times on jockeys. My heart goes out to you know, trainers and owners, of course, especially owners, boy. They're really having a tough go of it right now. My heart really goes out to them. But if jockeys can get through it, you know, and when we go back to racing, you know, they'd be out there working and trying to accumulate some winners and jocks mounts and go back to making a living. Because, you know, these tracks, if they can open, we hope they can open in a reasonable time when it's healthy and people can go back for the owners and trainers and jockeys to make a living. You know, one thing about it, maybe when they do go back, jockeys will have to have a health certificate before they can go up in the jocks room, just like horses have health certificates. And, you know, of course, everybody's going to have to be careful and social distancing or whatever we're going to do and wear masks. But even when I was riding, at times I was accused of being a masked understand it. So it won't be any problem jockeys wearing a mask. You know, I was accused of being a mask bandit, and I was letting them run. So if we have to go down the paddock and wear a mask and practice social distancing to some degree, I just hope racing gets back on track and we can all go back to making a living.
Well, exactly. And Tony, one of the names that came up this week, and I said at the time, I made the note, because Art Madrid's name came up with Andy Serling on Tuesday. And I said, I got to ask Tony. I said, did you rub elbows, share a room ever too many times with Art?
Absolutely. He rode in Jersey and Pennsylvania, and the one I can say a few positive things about Art. When it comes to being an athlete, he was a strong, world-class athlete as a jockey. Good athlete. Had a good head, knew where he was at all times. We rubbed elbows and temperaments at times. He hated my style of riding. And we never got into it. But you know what? He was no different than anybody else. There was a lot of guys I rode with that hated my style of riding. Because I had the style of riding that, I know where you want to be, and I don't want to be there. But if you try to go there, I want to be there. And they hated that, you know. I always felt like I'm going to make you go if I'm on the lead where I've already been. And if you want to be on the inside, I don't want to be on the inside, but I don't want you to be there either. You know, and a lot of guys took that as a personal insult against them, and it wasn't. It was just that way you were taught when you were a kid by, you know, the names that taught me, the Chris Rogers and guys like that. You know, it was a way of riding that was aggressive, hopefully not crossing the line. And every once in a while you did cross the line, and usually by over trying and trying too hard. But that's the way I was taught, you know. And some people have rubbed the wrong way, and some people adapted to it and said, well, I know what he's doing, and I'm just going to not be one of his prey, you know? And a lot of times they beat me. but Art was a good rider. He was a good athlete and strong. I know he had some issues where he got hurt on several occasions. Yeah. And it took away from his career. You know, and the one thing in this business, if you get hurt and you don't come back right away banging and winning, you know, of course, the first thing people want to say is he hit the ground, lost his heart that last time. I never noticed that with Art, but one of the things that plagued him was when he did get hurt a couple of times, people made that accusation. And I always thought of him as a world-class rider, a good athlete, knew where he was. And I didn't hear the show that brought his name up, but I had a lot of respect for his overall ability.
He won the Eclipse Award as Apprentice, right? He was Apprentice, and
rode a lot in Jersey and Keystone or Philadelphia Park, whatever it was at the time. Rode at those tracks when he won that Eclipse Award, and you know, I was an older rider, and he was Apprentice, and he figured out my style eventually, and you know, and life went on. And the one thing about it, he was one of those kids in the beginning that I thought, you're not going to wind up dealing real well with jockeys in the jocks room because you take things personally. You can't come back to the jocks room, turn it loose, and go to the next one. But you know what? And I don't know if it was the influence of the Keystone riders on him at the time. He learned to come back to the jocks room. Whatever went on the racetrack, he turned loose. Not in the very beginning. He turned loose when he came back to the jocks room and went out there and rode the next race. And if you happen to be one of his victims, you just happen to be one of his victims. But riders and young riders that usually have problems lasting long in jocks rooms are the ones that go out there, they get victimized, and they can't come back to the room and just shake it off and go to the next one. They're the riders that have trouble, I'm going to say surviving, but have trouble interacting on a daily basis in a competitive sport like horse racing. Horse racing is a highly physical, competitive sport, and you better be able to, of course, dish it out, but you better be able to take it.
Agreed. Madrid, Panamanian, he went to the Panamanian school and was a Lafitte Pincay disciple, or, you know, Lafitte was his idol. And he was really a natural, kind of a natural, like you, Tony, kind of a natural lightweight.
Yeah, he didn't have a lot of weight problems. But you got to understand also in that era, I forget exactly when he had the bug, I guess in the late 70s or whatever. I don't even remember. But anyway, in that era, horses got in lighter, too. You know, when I was a bug boy, you had to do 105. I'll never forget the day I went to the jocks room and, you know, and I had learned a little bit about weight control and all that, and I was doing 105. One day I went to the jocks room and, you know, I'm heavy. I got in the box, pulled like 3 or 4 pounds because you had to be, you know, it wasn't known to have bug riders cheat the scale, you know, use light equipment. That's what we call cheating. It doesn't mean you really cheat the scale. You get on, your saddle would have a light girth, you'd have light boots on, you'd have light colors, no undershirts or nothing, and you would check light. That wasn't usually accepted when riders started out. The older riders, they did it, but you a bug boy, you better not. I came to a jock's room, pulled. I was a little heavy that day, pulled like 3 pounds, couldn't get down to 101. I figured, well, I'm 102, I'll do 106. I did 106 on this horse. Went, and it was my boss's horse, went down to the paddock, it was at Liberty Bell. And he says, what'd you do 106 for? I says, Charlie, I was heavy today, I couldn't do 5, I pulled a couple pounds, and, you know, didn't want to pull no more weight. He says, well, the next time you do 106 on this horse, instead of 105, you'll be watching them run for a while. You won't be sitting on them. And that was the mentality. You know, that was what you came up with in those days. You know, when I was riding races, I was catching stalls in the morning, and you know, because I'd get there before the trainer got there. I'd throw back some stalls in the corner, get one or two horses tacked up. When he got there, I had two or three out, and, you know, and grooms and hot walkers and everybody. Life went on, you know, and then the trainer got there. But that was the way it was. I'll never forget going to the track in the morning because horses would get in light, and you'd be galloping horses. And in those days, you'd gallop 10, 12 horses a morning at least, if you were a bug boy, you know. And I learned a lot about sweating and reducing, and I would put my sweatpants and sweatshirt on, put a plastic pants and plastic shirt over top of it, and then put my jeans and shirt on and gallop 10, 12 horses in the summertime with sweat clothes on, believe me. You stayed light. But Art came about in an era where the weight started picking up a little bit, and they weren't, horses didn't get in with 104, 105, you know. And he was strong. I mean, if there was somebody in the jocks room you didn't want to get into a fight with, it was Art Madrid, because he was solid as a rock, you know, muscular, good athlete. And I knew better than to ever pull any of my wrestling moves on him. But he was a good rider, a very good rider.
You know, you bring up a couple of little side points too, Tony, that's worth you know, following up. And when you said learning about weight control, how much of that? I mean, obviously, there's certain guys that get away. You know, they just are natural. You know, natural athletes, natural lightweights, and then there's the ones that are taller, and you know, whether it's their height or and just physically needing, you know, a few more pounds. Who's out there teaching young riders the right way to maintain weight?
That's exactly it, the right way. Because when I came out around, there wasn't a real eye on nutrition. It was get light, get light, get light. I don't care how you get light. Get in the box if you're a heave. That was, you know, you want to be light, then be a heaver. If you're a little too tall, be a heaver. You could get in the box, pull a lot of weight, come out of the box, drink up, blow your belly out as big as it would get, eat whatever you want to eat, and then go heave it, because it would mentally satisfy you. It didn't do the nutritional value of your makeup any good, you know, eating and heaving and getting in the box and sweating. But now, you know, there's like I said, I even sat in the box and went in the cooling out room, and the guy would be sitting there lighting up a cigarette, cooling out. You know, health wasn't the same focus, wasn't on health as it is today. And, of course, nutrition. We even have nutrition in health class in schools now. They teach kids about nutrition. And even with wrestling in high school, they've stopped kids from pulling too much weight. You know, you have to be of a certain stature, certain weight in the beginning of the season, to be allowed to pull a little weight to get into a weight class below you in during the season. You know, nutrition's been more of a focus on nutrition. And usually there's somebody in the jocks room that'll pull a kid up and say, what are you doing? You know, I saw you last night, you're driving to Pizza Hut. You know, what are you going through McDonald's the drive-thru for at 10 o'clock in the morning when you should be up here getting ready to ride your races? You know, what are you going through McDonald's for? You know, and there's usually somebody up there now because, like I said, there's more of a focus on ways of reducing and nutrition, and I can remember riders. You know, someone like Menotti Aristone, Ronnie Behrens, they were sit at the lunch counter all morning long, eating heave all day long. Carl Corte, and eating heave. You know, you wonder if you do that for about 15, 20 years, or you think it might be just something wrong to your your physical makeup, but that was a way of life. Eating and heaving, that was it. And maybe they would leave their last meal of the day down. Vince Vercalli, I mean, he even taught me how to heave, and I didn't even need to heave. but it was a whole different mindset. And some of the riders that controlled their weight like that, I'm sure, paid the price in the latter stages of their life.
No, there's no doubt. There's no doubt about it, Tony. I mean, I mean, there's so many parts of it. The teeth, it's terrible.
Oh,
for
yeah.
It'll destroy your teeth. And people hear this and they say, I want to just bring one other thing before we wrap up. You know, people say, oh, well, you know how they're, you know, allowing for a couple more pounds and should they raise the scale of weight? And the problem with that concept, Tony, you can finish the sentence. Tell everybody why that doesn't work.
Raising the scale of weight just brings bigger riders to the jocks population. You know, one of the riders, I'm going to give you a good example of one of the most disciplined big riders that I ever rode with, and really a good rider, and Mike McCarthy, yep. Trevor McCarthy's father. He's 5'10", I think. He looked like he was a victim of Auschwitz. And I'm not trying to make light of that. That's maybe, I apologize if I offended somebody, but he was so drawn up. But I would watch him get in the box, and got in the box with him one occasion. He would only come out of the box, and he was most dedicated to his weight of any rider, older or younger, that I ever rode with. Mike McCarthy, my hat that went off to him, you know, for his responsibility towards being a jockey and a rider. And he could heave, but I bet you if he heaved, it was like in dire need of putting something, you know, not nutrition, but mentally satisfying his thirst and his hunger after reducing. And he might heave once that day. That's the most I ever caught him heaving, was maybe once a day. And he was 5'10", and I'm going to tell you what, he was dedicated to doing the weight. And he probably focused on weight because he felt weight was, an overweight was a detriment to a horse's performance. And you can't keep raising the weights and putting more and more weight on their back. But the one thing that it will do if you keep raising the weights, I mean, it just opens the door for bigger people to become jockeys, and that's all it does.
Tony Black, everybody. Tony, as we wrap, I got Mike Welch coming up momentarily, but did you guys celebrate Sunday, or are you guys on Greek Easter, Orthodox
Greek
Easter?
The 19th. Orthodox. You know that.
I figured for those that don't realize, Greek Easter is this Sunday. So
yeah, man. And everybody our family be going around and saying, Christos Anesti, Christ has risen. Christos Anesti. I learned how to say that when I was a kid, and we go to the midnight mass, come home, put a cross on over the door when we walk in the door with the lit candle. And I'll never forget coming home with the candle and trying to keep it lit, no matter what the weather was or how far the church was from the house. And we come in the house, and I say, Christos Anesti, and that was Greek Easter, and we have celebrated it. But for my little boy, I kind of celebrate both for him and Kylie, but Mom and all of us. So they get two Easters, and I get the one.
I love it. Well, there's going to be spanakopita, and there's going to be tiramisu salata, and what else?
Moussaka? The moussaka, and the turopita, and the curabiedes, and cururaikia, and the pita bread, and then pastizo. We got to have the pastizo. And I already went and got filo for the spanakopita. I already got the filo, so Mom make the spanakopita. I wish I could send you some. She's the greatest cook of all the Greeks I've ever been around.
All right, this fall, without fail, maybe on the Friday night before we come down, when we come down for Pennsylvania Derby, I'm going to take you up on this, Tony. You've been promising for ages.
I'm going to have you come to the house, not that far from the track, and you're going to have pastizo and spanakopita, and maybe she'll even make some Yvetzian lamb. Lamb and Yvetzian. I already got to go get her a leg of lamb I'm going to get.
Sure.
You're going to make the leg of lamb and potatoes and everything for this Sunday. But you're going to come and have the pastizos, my favorite. You got to have the pastizo.
The spanakopita makes me nuts. I love tiramisu salata. What's the cheese? What's the fried cheese? Starts with an S.
The feta.
Well, no, but fried on the hot pan.
Mom, now I forget.
For goodness sakes. I can't think of it either. Well, listen, happy Easter to you and everybody. And Tony, I appreciate it. This was great. We'll talk next week.
You're the best. I always enjoy it. And thanks for letting me come on. I appreciate it, Steve. Keep up the good work, and I'll be listening anyway.
The one and only Tony Black, everybody. Happy Greek Easter to Tony and the family. Let's take a break. Top of the hour's upon us. As I mentioned, Mike Welch. We're going to go to Gulfstream. Today is the start of the two-year-old season. And today, in the second race at Gulfstream, you got a 4.5 furlong event, a field of eight. And, of course, there's a Wesley Ward. Of course. Yeah. Wesley seems primed with Lime is her name. And 2-year-old fillies today start the season on the juveniles. Mike Welch next. Rich Eng ahead as well.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Have you heard about the new handicapping and betting app that is sweeping the nation? It's called First Bet, and it puts the power of AI-assisted handicapping, seamless wagering, and live HD video in the palm of your hand. Thousands of bettors have already made First Bet their way to handicap, bet, and watch more than 300 of the world's top tracks. Isn't it time for you to join them? And when you give First Bet a try today, you can cash in on a huge welcome bonus. Sign up with promo code SPORTOFKINGS, all one word, and you will get $10 just for joining, as well as a 10% rebate, up to $500 for your first 30 days. With that much free cash on the line, what do you have to lose? Get started at first.com/bet. That's number1st.com/bet. And don't forget promo code SPORTOFKINGS when you sign up. And if you already have an ExpressBet account, you're way ahead of the game. Simply log into FirstBet using your username and password, and you're off to the races.
Up to 18 years old or 21 years old in certain states to open an account with FirstBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal, void or prohibited. National Gaming Support Line 800-522-4700.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California and Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust, it's not tax dollars, and by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Serious.